Okay, let's do it. Parshas Chukas. Parshas Chukas is packed with stuff, and I'm going to obviously try and do it justice while trying to give a little bit of a broad overview as well. But just to kind of recap and kind of just talk about the massive amounts of topics and stories that happened in this parsha, the first 20 some odd psukim is entirely dedicated to the Parah Aduma. Immediately after that, Miriam dies. Bnei Yisrael get fed up. Kadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe, right, the bear, they get fed up because the bear Miriam, right, disappears. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, Moshe, go speak to the rock. Moshe makes a mistake, and instead he hits the rock. Right, and then he is punished, and he's told he's not allowed to go into Eretz Yisrael. So Bnei Yisrael, after that, keep on traveling. Moshe tries to get them to pass through Edom. It doesn't work. Meaning they don't let them go through. Kosh Baruch Hu says, don't fight them. And that does not work. Then right after that, Aaron dies. Aaron dies. Elazar replaces him as the Kohen Gadol. Everybody mourns him for 30 days. Amalek then attacks them because Aaron's chus was the cloud of glory, clouds of glory, the Anane HaKavod. That disappears. They get attacked. Bnei Yisrael defeat them, etc. Bnei Yisrael get upset again. Kosh Baruch Hu sends snakes. I'm not sure if you've studied this before. Shem sends snakes to bite Bnei Yisrael, and there's a big plague of snake venom and stuff like that. Bnei Yisrael say, we sinned. I apologize. And Kosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe to build a copper snake, and literally a copper snake. And Bnei Yisrael look up at the copper snake, and they are healed. We'll have to talk about that because that's really weird. Obviously, there is a they Bnei Yisrael go towards Moab. They also don't go through their borders. Very odd, very alluded to story, which we're not really going to talk about so much, where basically the bear Miriam flushes out a bunch of Emori soldiers that were waiting to ambush them in a valley. They sing a song to thank the bear, which is also, again, very odd, but we're probably not going to talk about it today. And then finally, at the end of the Parsha, Bnei Yisrael do battle with two kings. One is Sichon, and the other one is Og. Sichon Melech HaEmori, who lives in the city of Cheshbon. Cheshbon means calculations. We'll talk about that a little bit. And then finally, at the end of the Parsha, Moshe and Bnei Yisrael fight Og. Chazal tell us that Moshe was afraid of Og. We're also not really going to delve into that so much. Maybe we'll touch it at the end. But basically, a ton going on in the Parsha. Lots to talk about, so let's get started. So basically, first of all, when the Torah starts off, the Parsha starts off with Parah Aduma. So the first thing we have to mention is whenever the Torah mentions a chok, right? The Torah, Parshas Chukas, right? Means Zos Chukas HaTorah. This is the chok of the Torah. So before we discuss why this is the chok of the Torah, not the chok of the Parah Aduma, right? Seems to be telling us like a real rule in the Torah, as opposed to a specific halacha, right? Even though there are 25 some odd psukim about the Parah Aduma. But whenever we talk about a chok, it's important to discuss, I think, whether Judaism or Kosh Baruch Hu wants us to put our heads down and just obey and not listen and just be like, all right, God said so, fine. Or if we're supposed to kind of delve into deeper meanings and reasons for the mitzvos, even though the Torah itself does not necessarily give us some, right? Is it a higher level, right, to just like blindly observe without thinking about it? Or is it a higher level to delve and try to understand? Now, I can hear both ways, right? Again, if you're talking, meaning on the one hand, someone who just puts his head down and says, this is what God said, no problem. God said, how jump. Now, my question is, how high? So it shows an entirely devoted person, someone who's completely, no questions asked, he's an Eved Hashem. On the other hand, a person tries to understand a little bit better, you can get perhaps to the depths of the knowledge that the Torah is trying to give us. So as you might expect, and again, I'm not going to say any great chidushim over here, but as you might expect, there are different schools of thought within the Jewish philosophers, and obviously Elu ve'elu divrei lekim chayim, that both of them are legit. We'll start with, if you've ever read the Kuzari is, I don't know if it's well known, but he writes that basically it's better to put your head down and just accept without any contemplation, without any knowledge. That person is a higher level. But, he says, he does say, but if you can't do that, which most people can't, he says it's much better to try and figure out and figure out reasons and learn and kind of, you know, investigate almost, as opposed to just like being like, this makes no sense, I'm out of here. Right? It's definitely better to try and understand what's going on, but he says it's a higher level just to put your head down and be like, this is what God said, that's what I'm doing. The Rambam, famously, he writes it a little bit in a random spot in Hilchos Me'ilah. I don't want to get into what that is, but he writes it at the end of Hilchos Me'ilah that it is definitely proper for a person to look and try and figure out and delve into the laws of the Torah and to get as much knowledge and understanding as he can. The Rambam, interestingly enough, says that, he writes this in the Mernavuchim, that while you should study the mitzvos and the reasons in the background, so the details you should leave alone. Meaning like why certain korban has to be a lamb and that one has to be a sheep and that one has to be a ram and this has to be three korbanos and this one has to be... He says that you drive yourself nuts and that's ridiculous. That says the Rambam. The details are something you should not deal with. But in general, a person very much should try and get to the bottom of regular mitzvos. Now, I will just say that there are plenty of commentaries who say that even the details are very, very meaningful. Right? A lot of Rishonim, a lot of the commentaries on the Chumash go into all these explanations about the Mishkan and the Korbanos. Just off the top of my head, the Akedah Yitzchak writes that, you know, he points out that if one letter in the Torah scroll is missing, so then the whole Torah is puzzle. So he says the same thing. If you're missing any details, so what do you mean? You're gonna make a menorah with like five branches instead of seven, like in the Beis HaMikdash? Like what do you mean you're missing the details? So obviously that's, you know, that has to be ironed out. But the Rambam is well known that people should try and get to the bottom of the mitzvahs as best they can. Again, this is also Machlokas Rashi and Ramban by Kilayim and Shatnez. You know, where Rashi says that Shatnez and Kilayim have no logic to them, and the Ramban says, I'll tweak it a little bit. It's not that there are no reasons, but the reasons are Kosh Baruch Hu's secrets, and we don't know them. Right? That's obviously very different. Right? Again, as we know, Shlomo tried to figure out and understand the Parah Aduma. Right? It wasn't that he just says, well, I don't get it, so I chucked it. Maybe Shlomo tried to figure it out. Gemara says it was beyond him. That was the only thing that was beyond him. But the Rabban tweaks it a little bit. Okay, it's always important to kind of provide, I think, that background. Just practically, I like to always mention that there's a really a Nas Seven Ishma type aspect to this, I think, in terms of, you know, Bnei Yisrael said Nas Seven Ishma at Har Sinai, right? And the Torah says that they got two crowns for that, one for Nasa, one for Nishma. And sometimes there's a Nasa. Sometimes you put your head down, you act without thinking, you don't try to figure it out, whatever. Sometimes it's a Nishma. There's a place, a time where you can try and sit down and understand. Both of them are equally valuable. Bnei Yisrael got two crowns, right? Like I said, it's not that one is better than the other. I don't think there necessarily is a contradiction between the fact that, you know, there are some laws we do understand and some laws we don't understand. You know, isn't that like why that makes him God, right? And makes us human, right? It's almost like a little bit more comforting that there's some secrets going on behind the scenes. So I don't think it's necessarily a stira, but again, I always like to try and mention that kind of rundown quickly when we talk about chukim. Okay, let's get into the parsha. The Torah says, Zos chukas haTorah. This is the chok of the Torah. And I said, as I mentioned, I alluded to before, it's a weird phrase because the Torah should have said, Zos chukas haParah. It should have said, this is the law, these are all the weird laws of the Parah Aduma. So why does the Torah say that this is seemingly, right, there's something going on here that's bigger than just the Parah Aduma. Zos chukas haTorah seems to imply, if you literally translate it as, this is the decrees or the ununderstandable laws of the Torah. So what's going on over here? So there are many explanations. All the Parshanim talk about this. One of them, one of the ones that I'm fond of is as follows. They say that the Parah Aduma itself, the thing that makes it, what makes it impossible to understand, as the Gemara explains, is that it's paradoxical. On the one hand, right, if you sprinkle the ashes of the Parah Aduma after this very lengthy process, if you sprinkle them with the waters of the ashes of the Parah Aduma, a person becomes tahor, right? He's no longer tamei meis, he's no longer impure after touching or being in a cemetery, etc. But at the same time, the people who handle the water and the ashes and all that stuff become tamei, right? So that's weird. Right, that's contradictory, right? On the one hand, this item makes someone tahor. On the other hand, this item makes someone tamei. How does that work? So, two things. First of all, why is this a general rule in the Torah? So the first one is the point that we've been harping on the last couple of weeks. And you'll forgive me for bringing it up again. But things in this world, actions and items in this thing are not inherently good, evil, pure, impure, etc. All thing, the determining factor, how you figure out whether something is good or evil, pure or impure, is simply the details surrounding it. Right? We use the Torah to dictate good and evil, pure and impure. Mesilas Yesharim, we talked about this on Mondays, right? Also, that the Torah is our guiding light, that is our map, that is our ladder. So that's the rule of the Torah, that yes, the same thing can be either pure or impure, depending on the context. Right? For the person being sprinkled, he becomes pure. For the person handling the stuff, they become impure. Right? That's not a that's not a problem. Right? For this, for one person being obscenely wealthy is tremendous bracha. He can give amazing amounts of tzedakah. For this, a different person to have the same amount of money would be a terrible curse because he's miserly by nature and would never give anything away. Things are not evil or good. It just depends on the context. And therefore, this is the rule of the Torah. What the Torah says goes. And when the Torah says determines whether something is good or bad, that's a huge rule of the Torah. That's another rule, another way to understand this, which Melech Biederman points out very beautifully, is that purity and impurity on the same item is not contradictory. Because purity and impurity always go hand in hand. Right? We often think that if something is pure, it is here, and if something is impure, it is over there. Says a Melech, and explain, it says a little bit differently, but it explains basically this yisod, that they're really just two sides of the same coin. Right? When the Torah says, right, the beginning of the Torah, right, it's the sixth day of creation, Kadosh Baruch Hu saw everything that he had made, v'hinei tov ma'od. Right? And everything was very good. Right? Up until then, he said, v'hinei tov. Right? Then he says, v'hinei tov ma'od at the end. You know what Rashi says over there? What was tov ma'od? What was very, very good? Anybody know? Rashi says, you know what was very, very good? The Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara. Because if there is no impurity, if there is no evil, there is no purity, there is no good. Right? As we've been saying on Mondays in the Mesilas Yesharim, our job is to choose good versus evil. Our job is to acquire the positives in this world. In the next world, everything will be good. It will be kulo Hashem. If there is no negative, if there is no impurity, if there is no evil, so there's no way to acquire good. There's no way to choose. There's no way to accomplish. Right, I just got one of these emails from Victor Miller that he didn't send the email. He passed away about 20 years ago, but they keep on sending his Torah as like written up in little short snippets. So that's what one of the emails he said this week. He said, why does HaKadosh Baruch Hu hide from us in this world? Because if he would reveal himself, so there'd be, obviously everybody's going to be from. Right? If you have HaKadosh Baruch Hu hanging over your shoulder, what are you going to eat that treif? No, of course not. So we need the ambiguity to be able to rise above. So that's important to realize. That's a rule of the Torah. Life is going to be, say, tough, but it's going to be a struggle spiritually. It's going to be tough, right? If it was easy, you wouldn't be accomplishing anything. We'd be done. We'd all be in the next world, which is, I'm sure, sounds great, but I'm not ready for that yet. So that's, don't if stuff is difficult, if you're having a tough time spiritually, so fantastic. That's the point, right? You're supposed to rise above that, right? And Baruch Hashem, that's what we have to accomplish, right? That good and evil, pure and impure, are two sides of the same coin, and that's an important thing that we have to keep in mind, and not to necessarily to hate on the tough times. Obviously, we don't wish for tough times, but to realize that they're an opportunity for us to rise above. Okay, let's see. Next topic. Topic number. Okay. Let's move on to Be'er Miriam, because how could we not mention Be'er Miriam? Right, we know that Miriam dies, and the well disappears. And we know, all right, it's Gemara and Tainus, Rashi already quotes it here in the Parsha, that the well was in Miriam's chus, right? The man was in Moshe's chus, the Ananiah Kabbalah was in Aaron's chus, and the Miriam's chus was the well. What the Gemara doesn't say is why. It doesn't say what Miriam's chus was. Meaning, I'm sure she was tremendous. Like, I'm not trying to hate on Miriam, but I'm sure she was fabulous. But why, Dafka, did she get the well as her chus? Now, I will admit there are more esoteric sources that talk about this. For example, the Maharal in Netzach Yisrael talks about this. Full disclosure, I did not understand what he was talking about. He writes that there's some sort of to raise the physical to the spiritual from the Tachtonin to the Malas Elyonim. I did not understand what he's talking about. So I'm going to be a little bit more, as they say, Balabatish, a little bit more maybe down practical. But I think there's one aspect of Miriam that really doesn't get talked about a lot. And if you look at a couple of sources, so really it does come out beautifully. If you look at the Medrash, right, Miriam had a different name, right, that you guys all know. Miriam was called Pua, right? Shifra and Pua. Shifra was Yocheved, Miriam was Pua. Why was Miriam called Pua? So Rashi, at the beginning of Parsha Shmos, says, and this is the one we're all familiar with, or at least the one we're taught in elementary school is that when the babies would be born, she would say, poo, poo, and she would try to calm them down and whatever and stuff like that. That is adorable and it's true, and it is a Gemara in Sota, and I'm not trying to hate on that. But the Medrash says in Shmos Rabbah that actually Miriam was called Pua because she would be hofia panim. She would make her face almost brazen and stubborn. And the Medrash there gives two examples of that. First of all, she would stand up to Paro, and she would say, "Ave for that guy when Hashem gets angry enough to kill you," meaning good luck. Basically not threatening him, but kind of saying that good luck when Akash Baruch Hu comes around and decides to take you out. But even more famous is the fight she had with her father, right? Again, Paro decreed, if you guys are familiar, but Paro decreed that all the boys should be killed, thrown into the river. And her father, Amram, was like, all right, because there's no point in having kids anymore. So he being the Gadol Dor, or one of them, divorced his wife, and they all got divorced. So Miriam went back to him and said, hey, your decree is worse than Paro's. Paro's decreed on the boys. You're decreeing even on the girls. So they got remarried. So clearly, meaning Amram and Yocheved got remarried, everybody got remarried, etc. He realized, oh, that you're correct. So Miriam clearly was willing to stick up for what was right and even be brazen, as they say about it, as to be hofi upon him. And that's what, to the point where they called her Pua, right? Even though clearly that wasn't necessarily, let's say, the PC thing to do. Another example, this is not only this story. Another example is when Miriam says, quote unquote, Lashon Hara about Moshe and Tzipora, right? The end of Parshas Baalozcha. Now, if you're familiar, right, Miriam went and said, you know, to Aaron, hey, what's going on? I heard Moshe left Tzipora. They don't spend any physical time together. And so obviously she got Taras, etc. So what's going on over here? How did she know that? Well, she's not hanging out outside his tent. So basically what happened, the story goes in Parshas Baalozcha that there were two Nevi'im who were prophesizing in the camps. And they got two guys named Eldad and Medad. And they were prophesizing in the camp. And when the word got out that these two random dudes were getting prophecy, so Tzipora, who was hanging out with Miriam, makes sense, they were sister-in-laws, Tzipora just randomly commented, oy vey for their wives. And Miriam was like, what do you mean, oy vey for their lives? And she's like, well, I'm sure their wives are never going to see them again. And Miriam was like, I don't understand. We're all prophets, and we all make time for our husbands and wives together. What's going on? So that's when she went to Moshe. Right? She went, hey, what's up? Why are you not hanging out with Tzipora? Now, she was wrong, and she didn't realize the uniqueness of Moshe. Okay, that's already a different discussion that the Rambam already writes, that she didn't realize the uniqueness of Moshe Rabbeinu. And so Kosh Baruch Hu said to her, hey, I always talk to Moshe Rabbeinu for all the other Nevi'im. They know what's coming. They can prepare themselves, but Moshe has to be always ready to hear me. So he can't become Tameh by being with his wife. Okay, details. But basically, she wasn't afraid to kind of speak up and say something when she saw something was wrong, and say something that when make something right. Perhaps this, perhaps this is why she got the be'er in her zechus. The be'er is the water, is the sustenance, the thing you need to survive. Right? Can't survive without water. The Torah is compared to water. If you're going to continue throughout the generations with water and Torah, you need to be a little bit firm in your convictions. Right? And certainly nowadays, people are just kind of, people are very happy to tell you what they think. Right? They're very happy for you to agree with them. Right? And the world's very confusing. It's even more important to be strong in your convictions, to the point where you might sound a little arrogant. You definitely shouldn't be arrogant, but I think a person needs to be strong in their own kind of values and morals. And I think that will keep them going. Meaning, if a person is always kind of just nodding their head to whatever the peer pressure is saying, so that's not a great way to continue keeping the Be'er Miriam alive, if you will. So I thought that was appropriate thing just to point out over there. Okay, let's keep it moving because I see the time is creeping, and I am always wary of that timer that starts at the top, even though we're not there yet. But okay, let's go on to the copper snake. The copper snake is weird. The copper snake is super weird. And if you haven't heard of this story, so basically, again, just to recap, Bnei Yisrael, after they kind of they lost the Anane Kavo, they came back, right? They lost the well, it comes back, and then all of a sudden they started complaining again. There's no food, there's no water, even though they had it. They were upset with the mom. Kosh Baruch Hu sent snakes. And a lot of people died. They came to Moshe Rabbeinu and they're like, all right, we sinned. How do we get out of this? How do we heal us from these snakes? Right, daven to Kosh Baruch Hu, they should get rid of these snakes. Kosh Baruch Hu davens, Moshe davens, and Kosh Baruch Hu says, all right, I got a great idea. Build a copper snake and let them look. Any literally, the pasuk says, just to find it over here. Anybody who right, vayakol an ashuch. Anybody who got bit, v'ra'ah sovachai. And you can look at the copper snake, and you will live. And Moshe makes the copper snake, and sure enough, that's what happens. What in the heck is going on? So already the Gemara kind of points out, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, at the end of Rosh Hashanah, says, what was the point? So Rashi already quotes it, is that what Hashem was trying to tell them was that if you're bit by a snake, and you're, I guess you're down on the ground or whatnot because you're sick, so you look up at a big copper snake on a pole, right? So then just past that copper snake is the sky, right? It's Shemayim. So you look at the copper snake that's above you and you're like, oh, I see Shemayim. Oh, you know what? It's a Kosh Baruch who's going to heal me. Hashem is going to heal me. So that would cause them to daven and to tshuva, etc. The problem is, why need the snake? Like, you just look up, right? Why didn't Hashem just tell them all, just like, oh yeah, okay, everybody, just look at the sky and that'll do it. Like, you're building in extra steps. So if Melech or Biderman quotes the Imre Emes, he says an amazing point. Great vort. And I love this vort. He says, because when you look at the snake, you don't only realize that it's Hashem who's the one who will heal you. You realize that Hashem is the one who bit you. That the snake doesn't bite you if HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want it to. Right? What's the reason you got bit? It's because of the sins. It's because of the chait. It's not because of some random thing. Where do we get refuah from? Oh, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I forgot. What, do you miss Rafa'inu and Shmon Esrei? No. It's because very often we miss the point. Whenever we get bit, quote unquote, whenever we have something bad happen to us, we forget that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one, right, who arranged that. Right? So we forget that maybe it's because of our own shortcomings, because of our own failings, or whatever it is, some sort of sin, some sort of something that happened. That's why it happened in the first place. Right? That's so look at the snake. It's the initial bite is the result of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what obviously HaKadosh Baruch Hu heals us, fine. But it's the initial bite that is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well, and because of the sins that we did. So that was why he told them to make the snake. I thought it was very beautiful. There's a story I like to tell in my arrogant, when I'm feeling arrogant, is that, I guess we could do it. Why not? We talked about being brazen and arrogant. So let's give an example. I was once on a trip. We won't say what it was, but it was a trip when I was a teenager, and we had to sleep out. We had a sleepover. And we slept in a field somewhere, and sleeping bags, the whole deal. And I remember lying down and seeing ants crawling past us, like massive amounts of ants, like just tremendous amounts of bugs. Now, I hate bugs, but where was I supposed to go? I was like a kid on a trip, so like I wasn't leaving. So like I just kind of like snuggled down into the sleeping bag and just like held on for dear life or whatever. In the morning, let's say there were 40 people on the trip, maybe like 36 of us, myself not included, meaning I was one of the four that were not bit, but basically had their entire faces bit up like they had chicken pox. And it was like me and like three other dudes who were not. And I remember thinking, that can't be random. I don't know. I mean, not to be arrogant and not to pat myself on the back. Not that I thought I was a tzaddik when I was 14, but I remember thinking, that can't be random. There's no way they left these random four of us alone and bit up everybody else. Anyway, but that's the idea that we're trying to say. That Kosh Baruch Hu is goes through everything. That the bites come or the negative things come because of chayit, because of Kosh Baruch Hu, and that's what he wanted to. That's what he wanted to teach us by building this copper snake. Okay, let's move on to this battle of Sichon. Now, this battle of Sichon is also very, very interesting. Because basically, Bnei Yisrael are coming to Eretz Yisrael, right? And they want to try and pass through some lands. Kosh Baruch Hu doesn't let them go through Moab and Ammon or Edom because they have lineage and they're connected to Bnei Yisrael in some sort of way. They did some sort of chesed for them, whatever. So, because he promised Moab to Moab, and he promised, okay, whatever, talk to us again, because Lot's kids, right? Avram, etc., etc. Edom is Esau, fine. So they go, they fight Sichon, and basically they take him out. And they conquer all of his lands, and it's fascinating. The pasuk then goes on to this really random, almost side note, almost like you're reading a novel, like the narrator starts talking to someone else. It's bizarre. The Torah, I'm just trying to paraphrase it. Bnei Yisrael took all the cities, and they lived in all of the land of the Amori, of Sihon, in Cheshbon. Cheshbon was the capital. And the Torah says that because Sihon had conquered all the lands of Moab, taken all his lands, and then when Bnei Yisrael conquered the Amori, Bnei Yisrael also got the lands of Moab. And therefore he says, Alkein Yomru HaMoshlim, therefore the people who tell stories, the people who tell parables, say, Bo Cheshbon, come to Cheshbon, It gives a whole poetic type of background to the fact that Sichon had conquered Moab. And it makes fun of Moab's Avodah Zarah, and that Sichon, the Amori, conquered them, etc., etc. And then it says, Bnei Yisrael conquered Sichon and settled in the lands of Amori. Very, very odd. So Rashi explains, based on the Gemara in Chulin, that basically, Bnei Yisrael weren't allowed, as I mentioned, Bnei Yisrael weren't allowed to conquer Moab. They weren't allowed to fight them. They weren't allowed to take their lands. But what were they allowed to do? Once Sichon conquered Moab, right, then Bnei Yisrael were allowed to take the lands from Sichon and the Amori. Because Bnei Yisrael were allowed to fight the Amori. I apologize if there are a lot of nations here. I'm trying not to get you lost. Basically, long story short, Bnei Yisrael were not allowed to fight Moab. The Amori, Sichon, conquered Moab. And then when Bnei Yisrael defeated Sichon, they got the Amori lands and Moab lands. Says, again, Rav Melech Biderman, this is just one more proof of Rabos Machshavos Belevish, but that's how Hashem Yitakum. Right? Pasuk in Mishlei, that the thoughts of man are many, but the advice of Hashem is what is going to reign. Because to the casual observer, this looks like a big bully, war machine, conquering, expanding land. Sichon is the big, regional power. He just wants to conquer more land. This is a Russia-Ukraine situation, right? But in reality, what's going on? Kosh Baruch Hu is working behind the scenes, right? Kosh Baruch Hu really wanted to give Moab's lands to Bnei Yisrael, but because of whatever reason, load, etc., he didn't want Bnei Yisrael to fight Moab. So what happened? He let the Amori conquer Moab. He put that in Sichon's head, and then when Bnei Yisrael took the Amori, they got Moab's land, right? People, right? Very often we think that we know what's going on in the world. Right? Kosh Baruch was moving chess pieces and we don't even understand what's happening. Right? There's a Rav Melech tells a story of a Jew in Poland. Again, this goes back to what we've been talking about, right? That Kosh Baruch was in charge of everything and that we have to have Emunah Bitachon, that it comes to Latova. But again, a Jew in Poland wanted to move to America so he could make a Parnassa. And Rav Chaim Brisker said to him, right, Brisker Rav said to him, he's like, you think it's the location that makes a difference? Right. Yes, you're not wrong that the Gemara says in Rosh Hashanah that Mishanem Makom, Mishanem Mazel, that sometimes when you change place, you change your mazel. But that's not what the guy was saying. He wasn't trying to move down, a 2 days journey in Poland. He was trying to make a big move to America. He's like, I understand. Either way, if a Kosh Baruch Hu changes your Gzar Din and says, you know what, you've been poor up until now, you should be rich. So what, he can't do that here in Poland? Right, and if it hasn't changed in Shemayim, and you're still supposed to be poor, so why would you go all the way to America just to be poor? Right? Meaning, if everything is from Akash Baruch Hu anyway, so why are you making yourself Meshuga? Right? I had a friend who, fascinating story, 5 years ago, five, 6 years ago, he moved to Beit Shemesh. He was in Teaneck, making the way he tells the story, he tells it straight up, so I don't feel bad saying it again. He was making... Him and his wife together were making more than $300,000 a year, and they were breaking even. They were living month to month. And he said, in his words, when he made Aliyah, I remember the Chunkas of Ice, he's like, I could live month to month in Israel, or I could live month to month in America. So why would I stay in America? Again, this is not an Aliyah speech, but he had the proper mindset, meaning that Kosh Baruch Hu was going to give us X number of Parnassa. Well, what's the difference? I mean, where if you're going to make the same amount of here, he did the math. He had a whole calculation. I mean, it wasn't a speech in Yiras Shamayim, even though it was. But he said, he's like, I did the calculations. I was 300K here in America, and I was month to month, and I was, did the math, whatever it was, and making this amount of money in Israel, and it was the same. So why should I stay there? Meaning, if Akosh Baruch Hu makes a Gzar Din in Shamayim, that's what's going to happen, right? Regardless of what we think. So that's the most important. Right, to realize that Akash Baruch Hu orchestrated that. Why does the Torah bring this random poem about Amori and Moab? To realize that Akash Baruch Hu orchestrates all these random world happenings just to benefit Bnei Yisrael, right? And so, and just to remind us of that. The second word is what we mentioned on Monday about this pasuk, that Alkein Yomru HaMoshlim Bo Cheshbon, that the Mesillas, again, Mesillas Yesharim, he writes that what are Moshlim? Moshlim is Lashon Moshel, to conquer. that when we, again, this is shown in the beginning, the first couple of prakim talks about taking a cheshbon on nefesh, right? Cheshbon, right? I said the city of Sichon was cheshbon, calculations. So the Mesillas Yesharim, based on the Gemara of Basra, says that basically the people who were able to take a cheshbon on nefesh, right, people who are able to really take stock of their lives, right, are people who have moshel, who have conquered the Yetzer Hara, right? Only after you take yourself out of, or you start fighting Yetzer Hara, can you start taking stock of what you've been doing. Okay, I'm going to leave that for Monday because we're running out of time over here. I do want to mention two more things. Meimariva, what's going on with Moshe hitting the rock? Now, just to go backwards a little bit to the middle of the parsha, Moshe hitting the rock is something that we cannot even fathom. How Kosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu to speak to the rock, he hit it instead, and therefore he lost his chelik in Eretz Yisrael. We can't even fathom, right, what that sin means. But check out this amazing, this is an amazing board by the Bas Ayin. Lived in Eretz Yisrael, buried in Tzfat, died in like the 1850s. He says like this, the Rambam writes in Shmoneh Prakim that Moshe's real sin was not the hitting of the rock. It was what he said beforehand, was Shimu Nahamorim, Minasela Zenutilachamayim. He said, if you look at the Psukim, Moshe says, hey, Bnei Israel, you rebels, what do you want me to take water out of this rock? Meaning he was mocking them. He was calling them rebels. He was calling them Morim, that they rebelled against Kosh Baruch Hu. So based on that, right, that's what Rambam says, that was the real sin. So based on that, the Bas Ayin says that Moshe decided he could no longer speak to the rock. Why? Because he had sinned through his speech. And his speech, the whatever tiny minuscule chait that was, right, was no longer able to carry out what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted. What was the mistake then? Right? The mistake was that Moshe didn't realize that he was able to do tshuva. Or he didn't fully internalize and understand that when a person does tshuva, you eliminate any impurities. So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to him afterwards, Vayalah lechala hakdisheni, you should have made me kadosh, you should have sanctified my name. What it means was you should have believed that, you should have internalized and showed B'nai Yisrael that Kosh Baruch Hu accepts tshuva, and immediately after tshuva, the sin, the pagam, the damage is erased. Right? Even though we can't really truly understand like what we're talking about over here with the sin, what do you see? You see that when a person is down, right, they still have the ability to overcome and erase any problems. Right? Any tshuva is accepted with rachmi by Kosh Baruch Hu. Right? It's such an amazing musar, right? Especially in the summer when we're sometimes struggling a little bit, let's say. Right? The trick of the Yetzer Hara is to get us down and to make us believe there's nothing for us to do and we're just might as well just keep up. No, it's not true. It doesn't matter where you are. Right? You're always able to overcome. Melech Rav Biederman points out that there's another similar vote by Rav Shlomo Kluger. Rav Shlomo Kluger says that beforehand, right, if you notice in the Torah, Moshe did all the miracles with the staff, right, with the mateh, right, the mako, splitting of the sea, getting water from the rock in the first place. He hits it with a rock, hits it with a stick. Right? That was all before Matan Torah. After Matan Torah, Moshe, says Rav Kluger, after Matan Torah, Moshe achieved a level he didn't even need the stick anymore. But when he sinned and said Shimuna Hamorim, he called Bnei Israel a bunch of rebels, so then he thought he'd fallen back to his previous level of pre-Matan Torah, and that level, that dictated that he needed to use the rock, he needed to use the stick. Well, his mistake was that he couldn't do tshuva, right? Similar idea, that he could do tshuva and get back to that high level. So the lesson is, don't stay complacent, don't be content, don't be apathetic. You can always grow no matter what, no matter where you are on the ladder, no matter what's going on in your life. Just, I see we have 4 minutes, just one more thing that ties into this. We just finished Maseches Yevamos in the Daf Yomi. And there is an amazing Gemara, which everybody kind of harps on here. Second to, not the last page, it's not as nice, but second to last page. Basically, the Gemara says that Rabbi Akiva was once lost at sea. He was once lost at sea. And then one of the rabbis saw that Rabbi Akiva was lost at sea. Rabbi Gamliel says, I was lost at sea. I saw that Rabbi Akiva was drowning, and I got onto the dry river. All of a sudden, I turned around, Rabbi Akiva was learning the Beis Medrash. He said, how in the heck, how did you get out of, I saw you drowning. So Rabbi Akiva said to him, unbelievable line. Now, what it literally means, I'll explain literally and then what everybody takes from it. It says, Amar li, daf shel sfina nizdaven li. Right? A daf literally means a plank, but it also could mean a page. Shel sfina of a boat was summoned for me. Every kind of wave that came over me, I was able to, you know, duck my head underneath it and hang on to this board of wood. Now, that what everybody basically says is that when a person is drowning, what is the thing that saves them? And again, what if you need help to try and do tshuva and pull yourself out of a difficult situation if a person is drowning. So hang on to the daf. Hang on to a page. Hang on to a text. Hang on to some piece of Torah and some shir, which you guys are doing right now. Some sort of, you know, some sort of inkling of Torah. And then every wave that passes over you, anytime you have any further trouble, still you'll be able to put your head down and power through it and you'll be fine. So that is just something beautiful that I want to mention. Really ties in well at the end. But yeah, keep your head up, keep on plugging, keep on growing. It's great to see everybody, and we'll, I guess, see you on Monday, Mitzvah Shem. Have a great Shabbos.